As I alluded to earlier, we're trying a new format out on Sugar Tomatoes that is kind of a combination of our previous two formats, one that was a lot more discussion-based and one that was a lot more segment-based. I liked having this little discussion and having the elements of that. So I'm going to keep that in, but I'm going to do that by once a week requiring myself to do the burning question so that we can use this as a kind of venue to have that dialogue with each other. So today, the burning question that I have for R.W. Mead is, do we need scapegoats? Now, at first, I get that that seems like a kind of weird question. So let's rewind a little bit back to the magical land of my birthday and talk. So after I got back from dinner with my birthday and after I'd been texting with my friends for quite a long while, I was pretty much exhausted. So on a whim, I just decided to start watching Futurama for the first time. And when I start watching something, I can't just watch an episode or two. I need to just marathon. I've done that with Lost. I did that even with Glee. I did that with Fringe. I need to watch things as quickly as possible, back to back. And this was the case also for Futurama. Just in the period of now, all the way back until then, I have watched 5 episodes already. But my favorite of all of these episodes of Futurama has to be episode 5. For those of you who aren't aware with what Futurama is, first of all, what's wrong with you? And second of all, Futurama, it's been described as The Simpsons in the future. I don't really think that's much of an accurate descriptor, even though it is by one of the same creators, Matt Groening. But it is about this pizza delivery boy who is accidentally frozen in a cryogenics chamber in the year 1999, and he wakes up in the year 3000 when he's finally unfrozen. So together with his robot drinking buddy Bender, and with the kind of future one-eyed cop Layla, and with his actually great-great-great-great-great-nephew Farnsworth, who is a professor, he now does basically pizza and package delivery in space in the year 3000, where there are robots everywhere, where the benevolent dictator is named Mom and looks exactly like Betty White, and so many different things have happened, obviously, since the turn of the century, that he's just flabbergasted. But anyway, episode 5 deals with Bender moving in as Fry's roommate, living with Fry, but Bender's antenna keeps scrambling the TV signal, so they end up kicking him out of the apartment where he moves to this pro-robot planet. And the robots on this all-robot planet hate humans because a lot of them are impoverished, a lot of them aren't in the best economic situation, so they take it out on humans. It is quite clearly a metaphor for marginalized groups, for black people in the 60s and the 50s and backward, for people that are kind of in the slum areas and dealing with economic disadvantage. So in addition to being a very funny episode, it got me thinking. But I will warn you that I'm about to drop some pretty huge spoilers for episode 5 of Futurama. So if you don't want to hear them, and it is a very funny episode, skip ahead about a minute. So, Bender moves to this planet where he becomes pretty much the spokesperson for all of robot kind, who all want to take down the humans because they blame them for their economic situation. Well, it turns out, once Bender meets the robot elders, that the humans were basically a scapegoat. The real problem is that there's a shortage of dark matter, aka oil, and people are using humans as this scapegoat punching bag to distract them from their real problems. So that got me thinking, what are the current political scapegoats in our lives, and why do we need them? Do we even need them? Let me give you an example here. So the year is 1812, and the U.S. has just started its second war with Great Britain. Now, this was probably a very, very, very bad idea, because A, Great Britain is still Great Britain, and we didn't really damage it that much in the fight for independence. Even though we gained our independence, we didn't really do much to harm the British home country that much. So that was our first disadvantage. Our second disadvantage is not only is Britain not harmed, but we're way more harmed than Britain is. We are still very much recovering from the Revolutionary War. So nobody was in any hurry to start another war with Great Britain. And to even think of doing so, even though they haven't completely evacuated the U.S. by this point, and we really want them gone, is a foolish move at best, and a suicidal one at worst. Meanwhile, we've been trying to expand westward, trying to expand the California, Washington, Wyoming, Oregon area. And what's preventing us from doing this is Indian tribes, because Indian tribes have already laid claim to this land, and they're in our way. So the big issue throughout much of the political climate at this point in 1812 was, well, how do we get the Indians out of there? Do we make peace with them and barter with them, or do we go to war? Now, it's important to realize that when I say Indians, A, I'm referring to Native Americans, but B, we think of Indians as this kind of tribal, lo-fi, disjointed community, but really, by this point, the Indians were almost a nation. They were a homogenized group of tribes, and in fact, there was something called the Seven Great Tribes that pretty much had formed their own country out of what is basically the Western United States now. So, they had, I mean, they weren't as advantageous as us, but they had a solid government, they had rights for their people, they were making huge technological advances, and had they been left unchecked, they probably would have grown into a nation right alongside us. So it was very possible to make agreements with these people. And up until 1812, it was extremely probable, even. But what ended up happening was the British began to fight back against us. Not only were they refusing to leave their settlements, they were being armed. So, obviously, our first question would be, well, where are you getting those guns from? We thought we took them all from you. And we come to find out that the British and the Indian had made this kind of union together where the Indians were arming the British and the British were helping the Indians in terms of fighting and tactical maneuvers, so that they were pretty much this huge mass of anti-American people trying to gain their land back, because the British viewed America as a British colony, and the Indians viewed America as their homeland. So obviously they would want that chunk of land back. Problem being, there were people here and we didn't want to give it up. So in 1812, we officially declared war on Great Britain again, and the War of 1812 began. To anyone that says that America has never lost a war, even accepting Vietnam, we got our butts handed to us in 1812. I think it was something like 3-1, three American soldiers for every British or Indian that was killed, and things were not looking so good. Eventually, we were able to negotiate and end the war via ceasefire, but in terms of having any sort of tactical victory, we didn't, except for the Battle of New Orleans. Now, the Battle of New Orleans was obviously in New Orleans. It really didn't need to happen, as 48 hours before that battle occurred, a treaty had been signed ending the war, But neither side at this point knew this, because back then we couldn't just send each other an email or a text message saying, hey, let's not fight anymore. So Andrew Jackson, who would later become president, but at this point was a general, led the Americans to victory in the Battle of New Orleans. So his popularity shot up to the point where he rode on the coattails of that battle to a presidency. Now, if 9 out of 10 modern scholars are pretty much going to say that Andrew Jackson was one of our worst presidents, even though he had all of that authority from the Battle of New Orleans, even though he was one of the most popular presidents among the people, he very nearly killed the Federal Reserve, and more importantly, he signed the Indian Removal Act, an act which forcibly removed, a.k.a. killed and raped, any Indian in the West who refused to Americanize themselves. And by Americanize themselves, a lot of the times it meant, you go off into this little corner and we'll colonize all around you. Obviously, a lot of Indians didn't want to do that, so the Indian population reduced by over half during the Indian Removal Act. Point being that Jackson was able to use anti-Indian fervor, anti-British fervor, to get a very inexperienced, very oafish, very stupid man into the highest office in America. It is amazing what we can do to people when we say that we will beat up on scapegoats, whether those scapegoats be people of Islamic faith, whether those scapegoats be atheists, whether those scapegoats be gay, whether those scapegoats be Chinese, whether those scapegoats be Korean or disabled, or any other minority group. It is amazing how many people come into power by beating up on minorities and by saying that, I will not let these people come and take your way of life. So, having presented you with the evidence, my question to you, R.W. Meade, is, do we need political scapegoats? What purpose, if any, do they serve in our broader political system? And why do we need them, or why not?